Hi, this is Barry List at Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science of Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. How safe are America's airports? How does the risk of flying compare from country to country? What's the danger of terrorist attacks in light of the Christmas Day bomber? In today's segment, we speak with Arnold Barnett, the George Eastman Professor of Management Science at MIT Sloan School of Management. Professor Barnett is an expert in air safety. His article about cross-national differences in aviation safety will appear in the Informs Journal Transportation Science later this year. Professor, welcome to the Science of Better.
Thank you.
Let me begin by saying what I'm not going to ask you. I won't ask if Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, the alleged bomber taken into custody on a flight into Detroit, should be tried in military or civilian court. That political topic has been in the news a lot. I will ask about your comments in the New York Times shortly after the December 2009 incident. In a blog, you wrote, quote, "Paradoxically, the enormous efforts to protect aviation might increase its attractiveness to terrorists." What's your concern?
Well, the concern is that if we assume terrorists want to demoralize us, not just inflict physical damage and human costs on us, but just make us feel that there's almost nothing we can do to stop them, then going to the target that has probably been hardened more than any other since 9/11, namely commercial aviation, and succeeding there will have that effect on our morale.
You also wrote that even though measures have been reactive, that doesn't mean that they're failing. What's your assessment of airline security systems in light of the incident?
Yeah, well, what I was saying there, of course, was that people sometimes say that we're always fighting the last war. And I think we have to make sure we don't resort to cliches. There's nothing wrong with refighting the last war if there's reason to fear the next war will resemble it, and that the mistakes we made last time could be disastrous unless we correct them. So we do wind up, and admittedly it's not elegant, that we have a shoe bomber like Richard Reed, and now of course we take off our shoes at the airport. And now with the underwear bomber, there's talk about the body scanners and issues of privacy that had been considered off-limits years ago are now considered in a much more open-minded way. And of course this is, as I said, a bit clumsy. But on the other hand, as we undertake more and more security measures in light of demonstrated threats, and as we take more and more options off the table, we may force the terrorists into increasingly desperate attempts to destroy aviation, which have a lesser chance of success. And if we do that, we are making progress. We are achieving some gain in safety. Even if, in fact, some of these things are things you say, why did you have to wait till this happened before you did it? I understand that critique, but still, isn't it better that we now have, in effect, told the terrorists, don't try to do things in the shoes, we're going to be able to catch you. So then they're forced to resort to something else, which has a lesser chance of success. And we have not had any actual successful terrorism against aviation in the United States since 9/11.
I mean, I don't know how game theory relates to this, but clearly each side is going to respond to the other side, but it doesn't mean that we should give up.
I certainly think it doesn't mean we should give up, because the consequences of giving up would be extraordinarily great. But also, I mean, we have to say, have we failed? Now, there were reports that in the Bush administration, there was a plot to destroy the tallest building on the West Coast through crashing a plane into it. And that plot did not succeed. The shoe bomber did not succeed. The underwear bomber did not succeed. The attempt to succeed with liquid explosives against the transatlantic jets didn't come to fruition. So you could say that we are doing something right. That doesn't mean we were absolutely invulnerable to successful attacks. But on the other hand, we see two things. First of all, they continue to be fascinated by aviation. You know, some people said after 9/11, they've achieved so much in aviation, they'll go on to something else, whether biological, chemical, nuclear, or even if they're going to do things on the ground, they'll go to the shopping mall or the seaport or the subway. And yet they've come back to aviation again and again and again. So
because it makes good news.
Well, whatever the reasons, they keep coming back to it, and there have been successes. So it's important not to despair, which is one of the points I made in that Times piece, that this is upsetting, obviously, and I'm certainly worried about it, but we shouldn't despair.
Air safety isn't just about homeland security. It can also concern the design of airport runways to prevent accidental collision. You recently worked on a study about L.A. International Airport and its runways.
Yes.
Before I ask you about your conclusions, please explain the issues at stake.
Well, it was a fascinating study. It's just ended, and I worked on it with five other operations researchers, and we certainly will try to get our results in a form that they can be distributed to the informs community.
Right.
The real issue was that the north side of the airport has two parallel runways 700 feet apart. The airport was designed in the late 1950s when obviously no one was thinking about the kinds of jumbo jets like the Airbus 380 that exist today. And there's naturally some interest in moving the runways further apart. But, of course, doing so would be very expensive. It would also raise concerns within the community about greater noise and greater pollution. So it's an issue, I guess in operations research you'd say it's a multi-criterion objective function. You want safety. You want capacity for the airport to meet the demands of the 21st century. You want environmentally to have the cleanest airport possible. And you have all kinds of conflicting objectives. We were asked to answer one specific question. Is there any urgent need related to safety to move the runways further apart?
Who tasked you, by the way?
We were actually hired by Los Angeles World Airports, which operates LAX. The airport is actually owned by the city of Los Angeles. And there had been five previous studies about what should happen on the north airfield. The south airfield of LAX has already been reconfigured and the runways move further apart, 100 feet further apart, in the interest of safety and preventing runway incursions and collisions. So the question was, should they do the same thing on the north side? So the study was commissioned by Los Angeles World Airports in part in response to the community concern that the previous studies were, to use the word of a local representative, quote-unquote, irresponsible. And they said, why don't we have one last study by people who have no axe to grind, who will try to look into the issues and give us some conclusions.
And what was your role in the research?
Well, my role was actually chair of the academic panel. Much of the work was done at NASA Ames in Northern California, where human-in-the-loop simulations took place, in which they actually had designed layouts corresponding to the new configurations for the airport for the north, which haven't come into being yet. But in the simulator, they did come into being. There were controllers in a control tower. There were pilots in cockpit simulators. And they actually went through landings and takeoffs in a variety of conditions of visibility and different traffic mixes, etc., just to see what would happen in terms of operational ease and also various clues about the relative safety of the different arrangements. So that was done at NASA Ames. However, the actual analysis about safety was in the hands of the academic panel, which I chaired and which included five other operations researchers.
Was this an ad hoc panel?
I'm not sure. What do you mean by ad hoc?
This was a group that was assembled rather than an existing group that meets regularly.
Yes, it was a group that was assembled for this purpose. Now, these were people who have a long research interest in aviation and knew each other and had worked together in the National Center of Excellence for Aviation Operations Research that is operated by the FAA. So we knew each other before, but this particular group of six got together for this particular purpose.
And what was the conclusion of your research group?
The conclusion we reached had many parts to it, but the part that I guess got the most attention was that we thought that it would be difficult to construct a case for moving the runways further apart on safety grounds alone. And what we meant by that was that after lots of analysis of all kinds of data, much of it from the simulation at NASA Ames, but also all kinds of historical data and other information about runway collisions and incursions, we thought that the airport is extremely safe in its current configuration and would be, even at the levels of traffic contemplated for 2020, the higher levels of traffic, even including more of the Group 6 aircraft, as they're called, namely the biggest ones like the Airbus 380, that it was extremely safe.
Even though there have been near misses?
I'm sorry?
Even though there have been near misses on the ground?
Yes, we certainly took into account the record of near misses on the ground. We also took into account and examined very carefully what we can say about the new technologies that have come into being that are meant to reduce the risk of runway collisions. There are new radar systems. There are new runway status lights that turn ferociously red when a collision is imminent. And the FAA is quite optimistic that these technologies will reduce the risk substantially. We reviewed the evidence, the before-after evidence, when they were introduced at certain airports, and all kinds of other evidence. But certainly, Barry, we did take into account those near misses that have occurred at LAX, on the North Airfield, on the South Airfield, and at every other airfield in the United States.
I'm sure that critics will charge, or have already charged, that your group of experts were hired by the city of Los Angeles to prove the city's own point and head off community opposition to expanding the airport. What's your response?
Well, the charges are preposterous in the sense that the desire on the part of all parties, the airport and the community groups, they actually had the North Runway Safety Advisory Committee, NORSAC, was formed, and that was community groups, and not only literally residents in the area, but also the airlines, also the business interests in Los Angeles, which obviously care a lot about having a vibrant airport. So all of these groups did come to us and say, tell us the truth. That, you know, I'm from Brooklyn, and Spike Lee had the movie Do the Right Thing.
Uh-huh.
I really believe everyone wanted to do the right thing, but wanted to know what is the right thing. So we were under no pressure one way or the other from any of the parties, even though the parties felt deeply about the issue. I can tell you absolutely that no one put any kind of pressure on us, and no one knew, by the way, what the conclusions were until we actually submitted the report just last week. But the issue was, here was the difficult issue, Barry. We didn't deny that moving the runways apart would save lives. Everyone wants to save life. The problem was that the huge expense associated with moving the runways could probably save more lives and maybe many more lives if used in other ways. And this is the kind of agonizing dilemma that comes up again and again in operations research in the safety context. I mean, everyone would like to have a world of zero risk, but if we must tolerate certain risks, the question is why? And we reluctantly concluded, because we don't want ever to have an accident again at the LAX North Airfield, but we concluded that the cost of trying to reduce that risk exceeded the benefits. And some people were greatly disappointed with this conclusion.
But I gather that you put the chance of a fatal collision at 1 in 150 million. Is that right?
Well, that was the risk to a passenger at LAX. Meaning our estimate was, based upon various calculations, that if I were a user of LAX in the next decade of the 21st century, around 2020, for example, that my risk of dying in a collision on the North Airfield after I board my flight or when I'm landing at LAX would be about 1 in 150 million at the present. Now, if you move the runways further apart, that level of risk would drop. It certainly wouldn't drop to zero. because we have airports with runways further apart, like the ones contemplated for LAX, and they continue to have occasional runway incursions. But we were basically talking about a fraction of the risk of 1 in 150 million.
Are there broader implications rising from the study?
I don't know. The Wall Street Journal wrote an article saying that those around the country who resist airport expansion will take heart from these results, because often the airports say we have to do this for safety reasons. And to the extent that a study suggested maybe you don't have to do it for safety reasons, or maybe the safety benefits, although real, are not large enough to justify the cost and disruption, then it might be more difficult for some airports to make their expansion arguments. Now, they can continue, of course, to say we have to do this for reasons of capacity, that it's greatly important to the economy of the area, to the smooth flow of traffic, to reducing environmental pollution associated with planes standing on the standing waiting to take off. They can continue to make all of these arguments, but to make safety the centerpiece of the argument might be more difficult in the light of the study we did.
Let's turn to your upcoming study on safety in international flights. It'll be appearing in Transportation Science. You write that the average passenger death risk per scheduled flight is 1 in 3 million. Is that a reassuring figure?
Well, first of all, that figure, I don't know whether it should be reassuring, because that's sort of a worldwide average. If you just got on the next flight anywhere in the world, the chance of being killed because of an accident, or for that matter, an act of terror, would be something like 1 in 3 million. Now, but I said, you know, if you take a bagel or a circular donut, the center of mass of the donut in physics is the center of the hole where there is no mass, meaning there's almost nowhere in the world where the risk of aviation is exactly 1 in 3 million. That's an average across a wide range of possibilities. But it is a low level of risk, in the sense that if I were to take one flight every day at a 1 in 3 million risk of death, then the chance of dying, you know, in a, let's say, a 60, 70-year lifespan is extremely small. And on average, you'd be able to go many, many thousands of years before ultimately succumbing to a fatal crash.
In the study, you contrast safety among three different groups of countries. First world, like the U.S., newly industrialized countries like Brazil and China, and then finally developing countries. How would you grade safety in the first world?
Well, safety in the first world is far better than the worldwide average. You said 1 in 3 million. The statistic I came up with for the first world countries was 1 in 14 million. And that, by the way, includes all kinds of aviation, jet, propeller, all scheduled flights. And 1 in 14 million implies you could go something like 40,000 years on average before first succumbing to a fatal accident. The study focused on accidents and not the risk of terrorism. But so that's an extremely good statistic. Now, if you go into the developing nations, the newly industrialized countries, the ones that are practically first world in terms of things like life expectancy or per capita income, there the mortality risk per flight is about 1 in 2 million. And if you look at the third world countries that have not achieved substantial economic development, there you're at about 1 in 800,000. Now, all of these numbers are low, okay? So it's not a matter of safe versus unsafe. It's really safe versus extremely safe. But it is interesting, I think, that at the moment at least, and of course the data will change as years move on, that while the more industrialized among the developing world countries have a better safety record statistically than the less industrialized, nonetheless, they're much closer to the other third world countries than they are to the first world countries.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. You posit a couple different study questions. One was the very one you just asked: why is death risk per flight within the advancing world, meaning that China's so much closer to that in the least developed world than to nations like the U.S. and Western Europe? You also asked another question: why do the advanced nations form a homogenous group? But let me ask you to explain why the two groups are so close.
You mean the two developing world groups?
Yes.
Well, I might say, first of all, we don't know. I don't know. But there is a literature about cultural differences that some people have thought relevant to aviation safety. And there are certain characteristics. For example, I think the willingness to challenge authority, that if you think the captain, for example, is making a mistake, how comfortable you are in raising that issue and not feeling deferential. I think that it's, the sociologists call it power distance. The interesting thing is that in terms of something like a power distance, the third world countries are all very close together, I mean on average, and they are quite a distance away from the first world countries in that regard. And I'm not saying that statistical correlations are causal, but it could be that the fact that these countries in the third world have advanced economically, but culturally remain similar to others in which power distance is quite an issue about being deferential to authority, that might explain why you would not have the advances in safety, aviation safety, you might have expected based on their economic development and their success in general at achieving greater lifespans.
So there's a strong sociological component, or you posit that there's a strong sociological component.
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say that I posit it. I did look into the theories that cultural differences may contribute to differences in aviation safety records. And what I found was that the countries in the third world that have made major economic strides, and you mentioned China and Brazil certainly among them, that if you actually look at the statistical indicators about their culture, that they may not be as similar to first world countries as they are to other developing world countries. And the fact that their safety record is so much closer to the developing world countries allows the conjecture that cultural factors may be slowing the pace at which they reach first world aviation safety standards. It doesn't prove that it's correct, because in statistics we always say a correlation does not prove causality. But nonetheless,
that's a basic of statistics.
Yeah, it's a fundamental principle of statistics and operations research. So I'm not saying we have evidence that culture is the culprit here. On the other hand, those who believe that cultural differences can matter can point to the data as consistent with their view. You know, there was a case of a plane coming into John F. Kennedy Airport in New York from Colombia, Avianca Airlines, and the pilots were desperately short of fuel, and they knew it, but they were dealing with the air traffic controllers in New York City, who are apparently absolutely excellent at what they do, but also, you know, they're from New York, my hometown, they're a little brusque. And the controllers were perhaps not as vocal as they should have been in saying, we're running out of fuel, we have to land. And had they been a little bit more assertive about it, then perhaps the plane would have landed safely at Kennedy instead of crashing into Long Island, killing
it. Is that indeed what happened? Was that the finding of the federal authorities?
Well, I'm not positive exactly what the finding was of the federal authorities. I do know that I have read the various books, one of them being, for example, the book Malcolm Gladwell, Outliers, where he discusses this situation. And he certainly discusses how, if you just listen to the tapes of what they said to the controllers versus what they were apparently feeling, recognizing that they were desperately short of fuel, and you realize that they were, in their culture, trying to convey a sense of urgency, but to New Yorkers who really expect you to be blunt and say, we have to land now, give us first clearance, what they said was a little more indirect and didn't make the point. And some people have suggested that cultural issue even arises in the cockpit, where there are reports, and again in the book Outliers he discusses them, about planes that were landing, then the co-pilot recognized that the path to the runway, the glide path, is more complicated and wasn't sure that the pilot was aware of that, but somehow more obliquely made the point rather than screaming out, something is terribly wrong, and then the plane crashed, killing everyone on board.
That's amazing. But probably very difficult to remedy. You would really have to give an enormous amount of thought to how to bridge these
cultural gaps. Well, people are attempting it. They have now new programs, for example, for cockpit resource management, CRM. And they are trying to encourage this open dialogue in the cockpit and other things. The problem may be that to the extent that it goes against the grain of certain cultures, it may be particularly in emergencies that the old cultural reflexes take precedence over what you were told should happen. I don't know. Again, I'm just really speculating now.
You segment among different international groups. Do you also segment within the First World groups? The reason I ask is that a PBS Frontline documentary examined safety among smaller carriers in the United States. I was wondering whether your study looks into airline segments in relation to the documentary.
No, it didn't. Of course, the study preceded the documentary, but it didn't in any given country talk about what fraction of aviation is propeller planes and what fraction is jets. I mean, that might be one of the reasons for safety differences across countries, but the study simply asked, are there differences statistically? And then we go about the task of explaining them. However, I didn't see the PBS documentary, and only a professor would be arrogant enough to comment on it not having seen it. But I think it is important that we be calm in talking about commuter air safety in the United States. For example, the documentary was on the first anniversary of a tragic crash at Buffalo.
Yes.
Of course, there have been no subsequent crashes among the millions of commuter planes after the event, before the first anniversary. There had been no crashes of commuter planes in several years prior to the Buffalo tragedy. And as far as commuter regional jets, which do much of the transportation among commuter carriers, they statistically have a safety record that is better than the larger jets. You know, in 35 years of operation of commuter jets in the United States, look at the Embraer jets, the Canadair regional jets, etc., we've only had one fatal crash out of 35 million flights. And think of one in 35 million relative to the numbers we were discussing earlier in this conversation. They have an excellent safety record. And somehow this talk about commuter carriers without reference to jet versus propeller obliterates that distinction. And I think it's unfortunate.
And it seems like you don't want people to be alarmist.
Well, I don't want people to be alarmist. On the other hand, if it is the case that the pilots are fatigued, if it is the case that the training may not be utterly adequate, everyone wants that to be improved. But I think we don't want to get to the extreme of thinking that commuter pilots are people who are half asleep, who weren't properly trained, who are not being paid and are just almost dolts for taking a job where they're paid so little. This does them a great disservice because they do absolutely excellent work under very difficult circumstances.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Professor Arnold Barnett of MIT. Professor, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening to the Science of Better podcast by Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. For more information about operations research and this series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.